of military capabilities with the West.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parviskov.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Casualties reported as several explosions hit densely populated parts of the Afghan capital Kabul, including near the Green Zone, housing diplomatic quarters. In the US, Michigan Republican lawmakers reject President Trump's bid to change the election outcome in the state as officials in Georgia certify Joe Biden's win. Also coming up, campaigners warn of a new refugee crisis in Europe as asylum seekers attempt to enter the continent from West Africa. Thank you very much for joining us. We're starting with some breaking news that has emerged over the past hour. At least one security force has been killed and several others injured as multiple blasts hit the Afghan capital, Kabul. The Interior Ministry says the security personnel was killed after a sticky bomb ripped through a police car. The explosions occurred in densely populated parts of the city, including near the highly fortified Green Zone housing diplomatic quarters. The blasts come ahead of a meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and negotiators from the Taliban and the Afghan government in Qatar. An intra-Afghan peace talks was launched in September, but it has made little progress amid differences on some basic issues. The talks are part of an earlier peace agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban, under which the militant group committed to reduce violence. However, the violence has continued in recent months. Earlier, our Kabul correspondent Amin Alami gave us the latest on the blasts in the Afghan capital. Let's take a listen.
It was around 50 past 8 in the morning when at least 10 rockets landed in separate areas of capital Kabul, mostly in crowded areas and particularly in the Green Zone, where it's known as the diplomatic area of capital Kabul. The spokesperson of Afghanistan's Interior Ministry says that at least one individual has been killed and at least 8 others have sustained injuries as a result of today's rocket attacks in Kabul. But he did not comment regarding to the source of these attacks and the possibility who would be behind this mortar attack on Kabul. Let's not forget that this incident happened in Kabul today while the Afghan government is saying that it's committed to launch further military operations against terrorist groups to pound them or either to force them to say yes to peace talks with the Afghan government. In today's incident, as we have been informed, these rockets have landed in maize crowded areas of Kabul where thousands of civilians are there. So in this case, according to Afghanistan's public health ministry, it's expected that the death toll of today's security incident, I mean landing of over 10 rockets in Kabul, will increase.
Now, Republican leaders of the local Congress in the U.S. state of Michigan say they have no information that that would change the result of the presidential election in favor of President Donald Trump. The leaders made the comment after meeting Trump at the White House. The president has been reportedly pushing local Republican-led legislators in three states, including Michigan, to set aside the results and declare him the winner. Earlier, Georgia confirmed Joe Biden as the winner of the November 3rd election in the state after a recount. Trump has claimed that his electoral rival won the three states by voter fraud. The Republican president has refused to concede defeat, even though U.S. media have already given Biden a clean sweep. Meanwhile, more Republicans are putting pressure on U.S. President Donald Trump to start the transition process to Joe Biden, the projected winner of the November 3rd presidential election. Several Republicans in Congress voiced doubts over Trump's claims of fraudulent voting. Michigan Representative Fred Upton said he had seen no evidence of voting irregularities that would change Biden's lead over Trump in that state. Utah Senator Mitt Romney wrote on Twitter that Trump had failed to make a plausible case of widespread election fraud. Senator Lamar Alexander said Biden has a very good chance of becoming the next president. Maine Senator Susan Collins noted Biden should receive the briefings, office space, and access to government resources he needs to be ready to govern on Inauguration Day. We're staying in the U.S., where different cities have faced unprecedented demand for food amid new coronavirus-related lockdowns. In the city of Chicago, thousands of families in low-income areas have now been turning to food handouts. Volunteers say they have provided food to a large number of people in neighborhoods hardest hit by COVID-19. Many of those areas have been laid off from work amid the pandemic. Officials in Los Angeles have also warned of a huge spike in food demand since the start of the pandemic.
Pre-pandemic, we measure things in pounds, and we were distributing about 1.5 million pounds every week in and out of our distribution centers. And now we're running at 4 million pounds a week coming in and out of our distribution centers here in South LA and Commerce. And that's 145% increase in volume.
Michael Flood, the president of a food bank. Now, officials said the coronavirus outbreak has put a lot of pressure on food banks across the U.S., especially ahead of the winter holiday season. They referred to record low lockdown-related unemployment rates as the main reason behind the increasing need for food assistance. They also warned of continued high food demand in the next year due to economic impacts of the pandemic. Staying with coronavirus news, Canada's Prime Minister has warned the nation about a massive spike in COVID-19 cases, which can overwhelm hospitals. Justin Trudeau said Canadians should tighten up their precautions in this critical situation. Trudeau implored Canadians to stay indoors as much as possible and avoid gatherings to help stop the spike and loss of their loved ones. Several Canadian provinces have imposed restrictions on movements and businesses amid a second wave of COVID-19 across the country. The surge has also forced authorities in the country's largest city, Toronto, to announce a lockdown going into effect on Monday. Canada has recorded a total of over 315,000 infections and more than 11,000 deaths since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic in early 2020. Elsewhere, another weekly protest in the Chilean capital has turned violent, with police using force against young demonstrators demanding President Sebastián Piñera's resignation. Officers in riot gear fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse an angry mob in central Santiago. At some points, police aimed the cannon directly at the protesters, releasing a jet of water on them at quite a close range. The demonstrators in return made bonfires as barricades to throw rocks and Molotov cocktails. They called for the release of hundreds of people arrested in the course of their campaign that started more than a year ago. The movement that erupted over the price hike of transport has left some 30 people dead and thousands more injured. It, however, led to a successful referendum for constitutional changes last month. Campaigners warn a new refugee crisis is emerging as asylum seekers attempt to enter the European Union from West Africa via the Atlantic Ocean. Rights groups say the EU is causing many deaths by failing to create safe routes for refugees. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
A high-level conference focusing on the EU's treatment of refugees has just concluded in the European Parliament, Brussels. During the event, the 27-nation bloc's migration and asylum policy was slated. It appears a new crisis is emerging at sea as desperate African refugees try to reach EU territory.
Look what is already happening in the Atlantic. Hundreds of people are trying to reach the Canary Islands through the Atlantic, one of the most perilous routes in the world. They are dying there.
The EU unveiled a new asylum policy in September, but critics say the focus is on closing the bloc's borders instead of respecting international law and upholding the EU's much trumpeted values.
Our staff has spoken out against policies which are directly responsible for this unimaginable human suffering. Time and again, European nations and institutions have failed to act on their duty.
Many organizations insist the EU should be viewing immigration as an opportunity rather than a threat.
Behind all those people, there are hidden skills. We need to identify those skills and to use those skills in our European labor market.
The EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and several African nations to try and prevent refugees from traveling. During the Brussels event, Ankara was accused of using the refugee crisis to advance geopolitical goals.
It is wrong to endorse the popular view of Turkey as a victim of the war in Syria. Turkey is on war in Syria since its very last start.
However, Ankara is highly critical of the European Union over its handling of the problem. Refugees continue to die in the Mediterranean. Those who make it are held in very poor conditions on Greek islands and now Spanish islands too.
Perhaps the most compelling argument being made by rights groups for the EU to do more is because the West has fueled so much conflict in the Middle East and Africa, effectively playing a big role in helping to create the refugee crisis. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Okay, we're turning to other news now, where the United Nations Secretary General has urged the opening of humanitarian corridors to help civilians stuck in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
And we have been asking for the full respect of international humanitarian law and also for the opening of humanitarian corridors and the truces that might be necessary for humanitarian aid to be delivered in the areas of conflict. So,
Antonio Guterres warned of the dramatic humanitarian impact the conflict in the region has on both Ethiopia and neighboring Sudan. Guterres said the UN is trying hard to mobilize humanitarian support for more than 200,000 Ethiopian refugees in Sudan. He noted that Ethiopian authorities have rejected any sort of external mediation to de-escalate the conflict and provide aid in conflict areas. Ethiopia's Tigray region has been the scene of fighting since the federal government launched a military offensive against the rebellious local leaders in the northern region. Police have moved to break up demonstrations against racism in a formerly whites-only area of South Africa. The reaction has made the anti-racism opposition party, Economic Freedom Fighters, angry. This is not the first time the authorities have reacted to such demonstrations. Hassan Saria reports from Cape Town.
There are claims of discrimination at the school that highlighted the entrenched racism which resides in the broader community here. Among the accounts, children of color were described with highly derogatory terms by teachers and fellow learners, were excluded from certain activities. And when this was protested, white individuals from the area violently attacked those raising concerns. Protesters say by perpetuating this attitude, which is reminiscent of the apartheid years, youth born under South Africa's democracy are still being taught old racial tendencies.
That we are against the racism. We are not against the white people. You must be correct with that. We are not against with white people. They are humans like us. But the way they treat us, it's like we are not humans.
But today, as before, the police were clearly set to protect the white community, blocking all efforts by the protesters to make progress. Demonstrators point to a broader issue with how the government continues to target the vulnerable.
It was just a peaceful protest because no one did anything to harm the police. We were just peacefully and then raising our voices that enough is enough. So they started to do this thing because we are black.
This is an illusion of democracy that we are getting. It's just a democracy that we have received just only to vote. But in terms of freedom, we are not free.
Scenes of a riot that we have witnessed here in this area today. Stun grenades, rubber bullets, as well as water cannons used to disperse the crowd. And so they were prevented from handing over their memorandum of demands, which of course was against racism within this area. At this point, there appears little effort by authorities to make a move against racism here. The Provincial Education Department has rejected calls by the South African Human Rights Commission for a probe or any action against teachers accused of racism. The opposition left-leaning Economic Freedom Fighters, which has led these protests, say it is this attitude that will only ensure they continue with their protests. Hassan Siriu, Cape Town.
The UN Secretary General has warned that war-ravaged Yemen faces the imminent danger of the worst famine the world has not seen for decades. In a statement, Antonio Guterres said millions of lives could be lost if no immediate action is taken in the country. The UN has already described Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with 80% of the people there in need of help. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015, months after the start of the war. Riyadh placed a strict land, aerial and naval blockade on Yemen. The restrictions have deprived millions of Yemenis of much-needed food and fuel. The conflict has taken a heavy toll on the country's infrastructure, destroying hospitals, schools, and factories. Meanwhile, a leading human rights organization has drawn attention to Saudi Arabia's human rights record as it prepares to host the G20 summit. The Amnesty International said that the world leaders must take the Saudi authorities to task for their hypocrisy on women's rights. Max Chavidi has more in this report.
As the G20 summit is about to kick off in Saudi Arabia, Amnesty International is calling on the attendees of the meeting to take the kingdom to task for its appalling human rights record. The Crown had planned to promote its contentious reform agenda to the world and show Saudi Arabia is open for business. However, Riyadh summit will be solely held in the form of a virtual meeting due to the coronavirus restrictions. Amnesty International is urging G20 leaders to join the call for the immediate release of a number of jailed women's rights activists arrested in 2018.
What we said on the eve of the G20 is that Saudi Arabia's real change makers, the activists who spearheaded campaigns for women's rights, are in jail or facing trial. Riyadh is an inappropriate host.
Since assuming the G20 presidency in December last year, Riyadh has publicized new initiatives on women's employment opportunities, claiming that the kingdom is strongly committed to empowering women and girls.
On the occasion of the G20 summit, the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Italy has organized a webinar on females' inclusion in society. Human rights groups have slammed these initiatives as mere attempts to reshape the kingdom's image through expensive PR campaigns, presenting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
The Crown has spent billions of dollars hosting major political, entertainment, cultural and sporting events as a deliberate strategy to deflect from the country's image as a pervasive human rights violator, to whitewash its dismal rights record.
Saudi Arabia is using the G20 meeting in Riyadh to build legitimacy. Bear in mind that bin Salman is behind the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The kingdom is cashing in on Donald Trump's staunch support all along the way.
Saudi Arabia is the first Arab nation to host the G20 summit. The meeting of the leaders of the world's most industrialized countries and emerging economies will be held on November 21st and 22nd. Max Civili, Rome.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
The Zionist regime has pushed on with plans to build a new settlement neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, a watchdog group said on Sunday, November 15th, warning that such efforts were being stepped up before U.S. President Donald Trump leaves office in January. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Middle East Eye website, which is published under the heading Israeli Regime Moves Forward with New Al-Quds Settlement. Please stay tuned for the details of this article. The Zionist regime has pushed on with plans to build a new settlement neighborhood in occupied East Al-Quds, a watchdog group said on Sunday, November 15th, warning that such efforts were being stepped up before U.S. President Donald Trump leaves office in January. The Trump administration has broken with decades of bipartisan U.S. practice by not opposing Israeli regime settlement activity in East Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In December 2017, the Trump administration broke with international community and recognized the entire city of Al-Quds as the capital of the spurious regime of Israel. In November 2019, the Trump administration said it no longer considered Israeli regime settlements in the occupied West Bank to violate international law, once again going against broad diplomatic consensus. Current U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is set to visit an illegal Israeli regime settlement in the Palestinian West Bank and the Syrian Golan Heights, marking the visit of a U.S. Secretary of State to the occupied Palestinian and Syrian areas. The latest move saw the Israeli regime land authority issue construction tenders in Givat Hamatus, a currently uninhabited area of East Al-Quds, next to the mainly Palestinian neighborhood of Beit Safafa. In February, the Zionist regime's right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the approval of 3,000 homes in the area. He said 2,000 would be allocated for Israelis and 1,000 for Palestinian residents of Beit Safafa. Last week, the land authority issued tenders for construction of more than 1,200 mostly residential units in Givat Hamatus. Amim, An Israeli regime civil society organization that tracks settlements in Al-Quds and called attention to the tenders on Sunday, November 15th, warned that the next 2 months in the lead-up to the change in Washington, D.C. will be a critical period. We believe that Israel will attempt to exploit this time to advance moves that the incoming administration will potentially oppose, it said in a statement, pointing out that the bidding period will close on January 18, 2021, 2 days before the new U.S. president's inauguration. Air Amim reiterated concerns that settlement construction in Givat Hamatus would be a devastating blow to a potential resolution of the Israeli regime occupation of Palestinian lands, as it would cut East Al-Quds off from the West Bank city of Beit Lahem, disrupting the territorial continuity of a future Palestinian state with East Al-Quds as its capital as part of a two-state solution. If carried through, Givat Hamatus would become the first new settlement in East Al-Quds in 20 years, the organization said in a recent statement. Nabil Abu Rodaine, a spokesperson for Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, said the Givat Hamatus tenders amounted to an attempt by the Israeli regime to kill the internationally supported two-state solution. Critics of the two-state solution argue that it is no longer viable because of the Zionist regime's ongoing colonization, with about 400,000 settlers living in the West Bank under the Zionist regime law using separate education and transport systems in what scholars say amounts to a policy of apartheid. The East Al-Quds tenders follow the approval of 96 new East Al-Quds settler homes in Ramat Shlomo neighborhood last week. The spurious regime of Israel took control of East Al-Quds during 1967 Six-Day War before annexing it in a move not recognized by most of international community.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome back to the European News Bulletin with me, Robert Carter. Later on, we'll be discussing the major headlines, and in our social media section, you'll get your chance to have your views discussed by me and our social media correspondent. But first, let's take a look at tonight's top story. The state crackdown on Muslims in France continues to escalate after the president, Emmanuel Macron, demanded that French Muslim leaders adopt republican values. Macron issued a 15-day ultimatum for the French Council of the Muslim Faith to draw up a new charter that must also stipulate Islam is a religion and not a political movement. The move coincides with the announcement that France will close the country's biggest anti-Islamophobia organization, the Collective Against Islamophobia in France. As criticism of European leaders and their authoritarian actions against Muslims continues to grow, questions about the concept of freedom of speech are once again being raised. So, I decided to take a crack at trying to test the limits of freedom to insult and whether it was a right which should be allowed in all cases. Regarding people's freedom of speech has flared up once again in Europe, pitting those who hate Islam versus Muslims who want to defend their beliefs from ridicule. But is a person's ability to insult those beloved by others a right to be protected, or is it just an unacceptable form of hate speech? Hate is on the rise across Europe. Right-wing sentiment has become a powerful political force, and Muslims are one of the biggest targets. For anyone who wants to make it their business to upset Muslims, then the best way is to attack and insult Islam's holiest symbols. In France, for example, a well-known racist magazine, Charlie Hebdo, has enjoyed mocking religions for many years. But its obsession with Islam raises the most concern. With insulting caricatures of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad depicted on its front cover again and again. For many Muslims, it is seen as deeply disrespectful to depict the prophet in any form. Yet despite global outrage and an outbreak of violence, the magazine continues to insult with blessings from the state.
And I will always defend freedom of speech in my country and freedom of thought, of drawing.
So France defends people's rights to deeply insult 1.8 billion Muslims worldwide, yet the simple rebellious act of burning a French flag is totally outlawed. Elsewhere, radical Islamophobes have taken things a step further. In the Scandinavian countries of Sweden, Denmark and Norway, Quran-burning rallies have not only occurred, but have been defended as well. With the Norwegian Prime Minister defending a racist thug's rights to desecrate this holy book. That's right, Norway defends book desecration. You know, the practice synonymous with fascism and brainwashing. Okay, so some of you may say that I'm not a Muslim, I don't get offended by these acts, freedom of speech must be protected for all. Well, then why is it that freedom of speech is not guaranteed to Muslims equally? Across Europe, many anti-Muslim measures have been enforced, including a ban on Muslim burqas, a way which Muslim women express their love for God. The ban on mosques being built in countries such as Slovakia or Italy, an ideal place for Muslims to speak and share ideas. And what about all the new anti-political Islam laws being introduced in France and Austria, which seeks to conflate outspoken political Muslims with radicalism and terrorism?
In the fight against political Islam, the ideological basis behind it, we are going to create a criminal offense called political Islam in order to be able to move against those who aren't terrorists but are preparing the ground for it.
Does that mean I'm a terrorist just because I'm a journalist who identifies as being a Muslim? Is that what they call freedom of speech? Now, what if I told you that total freedom of speech doesn't actually exist anyway, and that it's a good thing? Take France, for example. It is illegal to deny the Holocaust, for obvious reasons. Also, if I was to write an article using the N-word to describe people from Africa, I could get detained in the UK for peddling racist hate speech, which makes sense. Insulting and spreading hate is rightly not tolerated, but when it comes to Muslims and Islam, hate speakers seem to have total freedom. This sounds much more like white privilege than freedom of speech to me. In other news, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that Jeremy Corbyn must make a full public apology over his recent comments on anti-Semitism before he can be readmitted as an opposition Labour Party MP. Mr. Brown insisted that Corbyn must make it clear that he has no tolerance for racism against Jewish people. Corbyn's suspension came after he stated the scale of the problem of Labour's anti-Semitism was dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Thursday he was ending the era of cutting defence spending, adding that he will be injecting £16.5 billion cash into the defence budget. The British Prime Minister announced that the huge cash injection would pave the way for upgrades in military capabilities, including plans for laser guns and an artificial intelligence agency. The military spending comes amid an economic crisis due to the COVID pandemic and government resistance to fund free school meals for children during holidays. A top Downing Street ministerial advisor has resigned following an announcement by Prime Minister Boris Johnson that he's backing Home Secretary Priti Patel, despite allegations of bullying. An investigation into right-winger Patel's conduct found that she had failed to meet the ministerial requirements for treating civil servants with respect and consideration. A government statement said Mr. Johnson has full confidence in Ms. Patel and considers this matter now closed. Well, we've now reached that special time in the programme where we assess the online reaction to some of the major stories. And joining me first for this is correspondent and colleague Richard Sudan. Richard, thank you very much for joining me. Now, let's go straight to your first story. What have you got for me?
Absolutely. So more on this, frankly, latest controversy to engulf Westminster. Of course, Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, was actually found in an internal Cabinet Office inquiry to basically be regularly swearing and shouting at staff. And it seems unconscionable in many ways that the Prime Minister in some ways would back Priti Patel, but then again a lot of people would say the Prime Minister lacks any kind of moral conviction himself. As you just alluded to, Sir Alex Allen, who is actually the Prime Minister's ministerial code advisor, has actually quit in a symbolic gesture given the Prime Minister's backing of Priti Patel. But of course, regarding Priti Patel herself, perhaps this really shouldn't come as any surprise to people, because she's characterised as introducing some of the most hardline policies regarding immigration. Under her own policies, for example, her own parents wouldn't have been able to enter the country in the 1960s. Of course, Priti Patel also had to resign from Theresa May's government after she had secret meetings with Israel. So this gives you some idea of the character of Priti Patel. And of course, you know, a lot of people would say that Boris Johnson's premiership is predicated on kind of hardline British nationalism, which many people would say Priti Patel is certainly an advocate of. And it says something.
It sounds like she's a pretty grim character, the way you're describing it. That's obviously your point of view, but I'd like to see what people are saying online to see if they share your views of Priti Patel.
Absolutely. There's not many people tweeting in support of her, Robert, I'll tell you that. Let's go first to Sebastian G, who says, Priti Patel, the sort of person who would unplug your life support machine to charge her mobile phone. A pretty strong condemnation there of the Home Secretary. And Mem says, I know several people who have told me how shocked they are at Trump's behaviour, yet have voted for this UK government, which are employing similar tactics after her Israel trip. How is Priti Patel even in the government to bully staff? Interesting question.
Richard, before we run out of time on this story, I want to ask you, for people outside of the UK who may not know very well, you know, she's obviously a woman in government, and she's used it as an example of how the Tory party is not racist and is inclusive. But obviously her reputation doesn't actually polish that image. Perhaps you could briefly explain.
again, I want to reiterate this point, Priti Patel has made life, many would say, unbearable for many of our immigrant communities from across the spectrum. She's introduced policies which have made it increasingly difficult for people to enter the country. And of course, many people would say she certainly contributed to the quote-unquote hostile environment, which unfortunately Britain has become characterised by in recent years, of course, not just under Boris Johnson.
I'm going to jump in, Richard, because we are out of time, and I want to move on to this next story. Some huge embarrassment caused in the US now regarding Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Tell me more.
Absolutely. So former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani turned attorney for Trump seems to have had a kind of figurative meltdown, but also a literal one in a video of a press conference, which everyone's talking about. Before we get into this, let's just roll a brief clip of the press conference itself.
And what I'm talking about is the absentee ballots for which there were no applications. And that's not just a small matter. The reason for the application and the reason to keep all these things together is precisely to avoid what the Democrats did in this election, which is to misuse the absentee ballot process and the mail-in ballot process in order to cheat.
He's laughing at the Democrats there, but everyone seems to be laughing at him and his bizarre hair malfunction.
Absolutely, everyone's laughing. And of course, you know, Giuliani's really sticking his political neck out for Donald Trump. But we've seen Donald Trump fire several of his advisors recently and, of course, over the years. And so Rudy Giuliani may well find himself thrown under the wayside. We've seen incredible accusations, including claims that apparently Venezuela and also Cuba have undermined the election, although Jimmy Carter, former president, has actually said Venezuela has some of the freest and fairest elections in the world. And I would say there's kind of an academic quality, many people think, regarding the US sort of singing about the democratic process. Much of the world would actually say that whoever is in power, be it red or blue, be it Republican or Democrat, the United States, historically and in the modern context, has done, you know, many, many things to undermine real democratic processes and movements all across the world. So, I mean, this is the latest embarrassment for Washington, but I suspect, Robert, we're going to see a few more in the coming weeks.
For sure, it's the latest in a long line of embarrassments, I dare say, for the White House right now. But let's go to social media, because I'm sure, you know, this funny video hasn't gone unnoticed online.
Absolutely, nearly broke the internet. Let's go first to Goody Howe, who says, Trump is a national disgrace. Trump's claims about voter fraud are as real as the colour of Giuliani's hair. And Stu Cameron says, Rudy Giuliani is still unsuccessfully trying to change the colour of the election map when he can't successfully change the colour of his own hair. And I wish I could say these tweets were the exception to the rule, but I've seen loads of them, Robert.
Fake tans, fake hair, fake elections. What is real in the US? That's the big question I have now. Thank you very much, Richard Sudan, for speaking to us there. Well, moving on now, the World Health Organization has declared that the new round of lockdowns implemented in many European countries could have been avoided and should have only been imposed as a last resort. The WHO regional director for Europe, Dr. Hans Kluger, has advised that mask wearing, social distancing and self-isolation, if done properly, would be enough to prevent economically suffocating lockdowns. Dr. Kluger added that despite encouraging news about vaccines, they should not be viewed as a silver bullet, as supplies will be limited, particularly in the beginning. In the US, the Trump campaign has alleged more voter fraud as former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani announced more litigation that aims to secure his candidate a second term in the White House. Well, Murtaza Jaffa brings us the latest.
The election process in the United States is under further scrutiny after Rudy Giuliani, the personal attorney of US President Donald Trump, held a press conference to reiterate claims of voter fraud by Democratic candidate Joe Biden.
The company counting our vote with control over our vote is owned by two Venezuelans who were allies of Chavez, are present allies of Maduro, with a company whose chairman is a close associate and business partner of George Soros, the biggest donor to the Democrat Party, the biggest donor to Antifa,
and the biggest donor to Black Lives Matter. My goodness, what do we have to do to get you to give our people the truth?
The former New York City mayor was widely mocked in the mainstream media after he appeared to sweat off some of his hair dye in images that made front pages around the world. Pro-Biden commentators joked that the Trump team were literally melting away. Senior Republicans have also begun to call for an end to Trump's refusal to concede the election. Former Republican candidate Senator Mitt Romney took to Twitter and condemned Trump's team. He said it was difficult to imagine a worse, more undemocratic action by a sitting American president. Meanwhile, President-elect Joe Biden held a press conference after a meeting with a number of governors and criticized the Trump campaign.
I think they're witnessing incredible irresponsibility, incredibly damaging messages being sent to the rest of the world about how democracy functions. And I think it is, I don't know his motive, but I just think it's totally irresponsible.
Trump is facing a number of federal charges with allegations of tax fraud in a number of states. Some believe a pledge of pardon from the incoming president will persuade him to move on. But for now, Trump is standing firm, backed by his huge electoral base, and for the moment, the majority of Republican senators.
Well, we're heading back over to social media, only this time I'm joined in the studio by my other colleague, Robert Inlakesh. Thank you very much, Rob, for joining me. Now, let's head over to your stories. Your first one takes us to occupied Palestine, where Pompeo has visited some illegal Israeli settlements, I believe.
Yes, in both the Golan Heights, which is illegally occupied by Israel and belongs rightfully to Syria, according to international law, and the occupied West Bank, which belongs to the Palestinian people according to international law. But, however, we know since 2019, the Trump administration has considered these two territories to be part of Israel officially, essentially recognizing an annexation of the land, which, of course, would be in contrary to international law. And his visit, his recent visit, was the first of its kind by a U.S. official to an Israeli or Golan Heights settlement. And of course, when he went there, he endorsed, not only did he go there and endorse the settlement, say that they were legitimate, but then he went on to say that Israeli settler goods should be labeled as products from Israel proper, again, against international law, promoted them, and then went on to slam BDS as a cancer, as he describes it, calling it anti-Semitic, and therefore labeling the likes of Black Lives Matter and many other groups in the United States, progressive groups in the United States, as being anti-Semitic when their whole thing is fighting racism. On top of that as well, he's been implicated in the expansion of settlements and the endorsing expansion of settlements in East Jerusalem al-Quds, the Givat Hamatos, Ramat Shlomo, and the Atarot settlements, which would basically form a ring around East Jerusalem al-Quds, making it absolutely impossible for there to be a viable capital for a future state, a Palestinian state, if, of course, that was what the Israelis were actually looking for.
Looks like he's on the verge of ending his time in the White House on political low, attacking both the BDS movement, which is a peaceful pro-Palestine movement, and Palestine itself, Rob. Let's go to social media and see what people are saying online. What's the reaction been?
Well, the first one we have here from Joe Catron, who points out that Amnesty International said the State Department's attack on the BDS movement violates freedom of expression and endangers human rights protection. We've got another one here commenting on this issue as well. They say, you are inverting reality. Like its predecessor, South Africa, BDS is inherently an anti-racist movement designed to free people from racist oppression. Denying them that right makes the U.S. regime a racist regime. Not only that, you will foment foment anti-Semitism by doing this. And a lot of people have brought up that, in fact, equating Zionism and all Jews is something in of itself extremely anti-Semitic.
And that's something which the U.S. Foreign Office actually did on its Twitter page, I believe. It did actually make very clear a statement that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, but we all know that many Zionists are not actually Jews at all, and many Jews are anti-Zionist.
Absolutely, and not only that, but back in the 1970s, in 1975, I believe, the United Nations actually adopted Zionism as a form of racism. That was later reversed in 1991. But this has been, you know, in the popular discourse for some time, that Zionism as an idea, as a European settler colonial idea, is tantamount to racism. And so when they're saying that Zionism is akin to all Jewish people, you're trying to basically paint a broad brush over Jews and say that they're all racists, which is outrageous.
It is outrageous. Of course, that's not true either, so we stand by that statement. Let's move on to your final story of the evening. It takes us to Saudi Arabia now. Seems as if they're pro-nuclear armament. Tell me more.
Absolutely. So we have the statement coming out of Saudi Arabia, sort of threatening Iran, saying that they will look at an option of attempting to arm themselves with a nuclear weapon. I mean, really, Mohammed bin Salman must be trying to pursue a career in stand-up comedy, because this is just absolutely hilarious if you look at it. The likelihood of them being able to attain a nuclear weapon is so slight. I mean, the United Arab Emirates, which is much better, much smarter, strategic than Saudi Arabia is, a lot more capable, just had an arms deal worth over $100 billion with the United States, which would have benefited the United States, blocked in the Senate. And that was just for things like F-35s, etc., other military equipment, which, you know, a lot of senators felt shouldn't go to the UAE. Saudi Arabia is a lot more radical. Saudi Arabia, of course, can't even fight off Ansarullah inside of Yemen, and is open to attacks like we saw the very successful, well-organized attack, which was extremely well done, against the Aramco facilities just last year. I mean, Saudi Arabia trying to threaten Iran at this point is just comical.
Well, the one thing that I will say on this, obviously you have your views, Rob, is that the fact that Saudi Arabia is talking as if a nuclear armament is a thing that they're happy to pursue, when the leader of the Islamic Revolution has always made clear that Iran has no interest in building a nuclear weapon because they just don't believe in it. It's not moral. It's not acceptable. This is something which I've always respected, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Absolutely. And on top of that, if we look at this, I mean, the United States are talking, obviously, they justify their sanctions. They attempt to justify their sanctions against Iran by saying, look, they want to, look, they're radical Islamists, as they say, and they want to acquire a nuclear weapon. But then you have Saudi Arabia, which, you know, has had links to funding Al-Qaeda-linked groups inside of Syria. And they're openly talking about arming themselves with a nuclear weapon, but no sanctions there for Saudi Arabia, no cancelling of weapons deals for them.
You've raised some very interesting points. I will take us straight to social media, though, before we run out of time, and perhaps you could tell me what people are saying online about this.
The first comment we've got here says, what is Trump up to in his final weeks in office? He wants to reduce the size of our forces in Afghanistan and Iraq while provoking tensions in Iran, creating a destabilizing effect in the greater Middle Eastern region. And then we have another one here by Twitter account Station Shippen, who says, the Saudis couldn't pull a military victory off against a small Bedouin tribe equipped with camels and swords. I hope it truly believes it can beat Iran. We get to see the end of the Saudi regime if they try anything. Grab the popcorn. So a very, of course, passionate response there.
Thank you very much, Robert Inlakesh. We are unfortunately out of time, so we'll have to leave it there. But thank you for joining me. And thank you to everyone else for joining us on this edition of the program. Thank you very much for now. It's goodbye from us.
Slower storm decay after landfall in the future would directly result in increases in total damage, and this would be exacerbated by increases in peak wind speed and total rainfall, both of which are expected to occur in a warming climate. Please stay tuned for an article in this regard written jointly by Dan Chavez and Jai Chen, writers. This article is published under the heading, Tropical Cyclones Could Last Longer After Landfall in a Warming World. Here's the details of this article. Tropical cyclones weaken after they reach land, but it emerges that for the North Atlantic basin, storms are weakening more slowly as regional sea surface temperatures increase. Tropical cyclones can cause substantial damage and death when they reach land as a result of wind, storm surges, and rainfall. It is known that tropical cyclone intensity, measured by maximum wind speed, typically decreases rapidly after the storm reaches land. However, existing models do not take into account whether and how this rate of storm decay after landfall depends on climate. Writing in Nature, Lee and Chakraborty report that the rate at which tropical cyclones from North Atlantic decay after landfall has changed since 1960s, their intensity has been decreasing more slowly over time. This shift is mainly due to warming sea surface temperatures. The author's work adds weight to growing concerns that tropical cyclones might become more damaging in the future. Lee and Chakraborty analyzed historical intensity data for storms that made landfall over North America between 1967 and 2018. They used the decrease in storm intensity over the 24 hours after landfall to define a time scale of decay for each storm. They then examined trends in this time scale. The authors found a significant long-term shift towards a slower decay, so storms maintain a higher intensity on land for longer. Furthermore, this trend aligned with